That's largely, you know, everybody's looking for like a hack, right? Everybody's looking for a hack of like, you know, I work with guys that don't want to drink anymore, you know, and it, there's no way out other than the work. Like there just isn't, you know, so you'll get guys that will come to you and they'll say stuff like, I just need you to help me stop drinking. I'll pay you X amount a month. Just help me stop drinking. And I have to stop drinking by this date. And you're like, not how it works. No, there's no magic. Is there a pill? No. Is there, I heard there's like an anti hangover pill in Bolivia. And you're like, no, there's not. There's
tidy your room. Why don't you just tidy your room?
Tidy your room. Go pet a cat.
But
everybody's looking for that hack, right? And until, you know, self-help books, Zig Ziglar, Tony Robbins, all that stuff, magic, you know, blankets and all the things, you know, wellness and drinks. And Joe Rogan literally has made a multi-million dollar empire with the idea that he's got some hacks that nobody else has and he's got answers nobody else does. But I have yet to meet anybody that's achieved a new perspective, right, in this life, where they've been able to get on top of their anger, their sadness, their misery, their confusion without doing the work. And I have yet to meet a single person who's gotten better by saying, yeah, it's their fault. So see, I'm good now. Like I've yet to meet any of those people. No one.
Yeah, 100%. You're absolutely right. And the other weird thing about it is, I guess what social media has done is make everybody feel like they're an expert on everything, right? Mm. So everybody's I didn't know that there were, I had no idea. Like there were so many epidemiologists,
until infectious disease experts, or they're all over the place.
I mean, it's crazy. Like, you know, and it's weird that they're working as Uber drivers and stuff. but they're everywhere, right? And Jordan Peterson's an epidemiologist. I thought he was a clinical psychologist. He's a he's a climatologist as well. I didn't know that.
He's a gender expert too. I don't know.
He must have read every book that's going, right? But the only weird thing is, so sometimes people say, well, it's tough.
Yeah.
Because how do you sort out the genuine experts from the charlatans or the bogus experts, the pseudo experts, right? And I hear that all the time. People say, I don't know how to believe. And there's not a golden answer to that, right? But if you look at how people normally do it, I mean, where you should start with is, look, there are some people that are really confused about which experts to believe. And then there's other people that don't seem as confused about it. So what are they doing? Like, well, look, the one clue, and it's not rock solid, but it's a starting point that people normally use, is this guy considered an expert in this field by other experts in the field, right? And, you know, like, I don't think...
So can I ask you the question? Do you look at, like, because you're a psychologist, you're a cognitive behavioral therapist.
Cognitive behavioral therapist.
Therapist, you are an author, you are a historian, you are accountable, you know, you know the same thing I do, and you know way more about it than me, that you're not exempt from the work of psychologically making yourself a better person, a happier person, and that comes through deeds and repeatable actions. Is anybody in your field, as a cognitive behavioral therapist, is anybody in your field, do they look at Jordan Peterson, just Jordan Peterson? Let's leave Andrew Tate out of it because he's just insane.
That's obvious. He's obviously Andrew Tate's not.
No, he's just an idiot. But Jordan Peterson parades around like he's a self-help guy.
The weird thing is that we would even get asked about that, because the answer is, I mean, maybe out there somewhere, maybe if we put this out, there'll be like loads of people coming and go, oh, I'm a clinical psychologist, nothing, Jordan. But I have never met a single person that worked in mental health or clinical psychology that regarded Jordan Peterson as an expert in that field. Now, he's a highly published author. He's a professor. He was a professor of clinical psychology. But on the other hand, he often says things that seem completely at odds with clinical best practice or the research evidence. At least in 12 Rules, which I've read cover to cover twice, he never mentions...
Sorry.
So I had to, like... But he never mentions cognitive behavioral therapy once. He never mentions, but he also never mentions any of the research on mental health that we draw. He mentions some study about lobsters, I think, and a couple of things like that, but he doesn't, it's very odd. Like, I would never have guessed that that book was even written by a clinical psychologist, let alone a professor of clinical psychology, because he doesn't talk about the research evidence in his own field.
Yeah.
Right? At any point in the book.
But you'd think a researcher, like an expert, a guy like claims himself to be a self-proclaimed expert or something, would talk about what he is an expert in some of his writings.
It's just very odd, right? Yeah. And so instead, what he does is say a bunch of unusual things.
It's a nice way to say it.
Yeah. Some of which are kind of make sense, and some seem like really blown out of proportion. And he leaves out a lot of, like, if you're going to talk to people about anxiety, maybe it's like this problem of the great statesman that we mentioned earlier. We have to remind people there are thousands and thousands of research studies on mental health, right? So we know, there's a lot of things that psychotherapists don't know, but there are things that we know loads about. And there are even problems that we have a 90% success rate in treating. Like, clinicians have a huge success rate in treating animal phobias, like what we call specific phobias, panic disorder, insomnia. We have a pretty high success rate in treating social anxiety and PTSD. Like, and actually a very moderate success rate, not very good success rate in treating personality disorders and clinical depression, for example, although that's kind of getting better. But anxiety disorders, we've got really good success rate for the majority of them. And so there's loads of, if you're a clinical, any type of clinician, a cognitive behavioral therapist, clinical psychologist, and you write a book, you're probably going to say, this is what all the research tells us, right? But maybe it seems like a little bit boring, because every professional writing about that is going to end up saying broadly similar things, because it's the truth, like, about what we know. There's basic stuff about the way that anxiety works that every clinician takes for granted, because it's so robustly established in our field. It would be like, you know, changing the oil in a car or making an omelet or something. It's like basic stuff. So when you read a book by someone like Jordan Peterson and it doesn't mention it, it's also really it just seems really odd that he's leaving information out that is like fundamental to the stuff. So he says
the whole point, leaving out the whole point. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I used this example before, but he talks about people who have low confidence and low self-esteem. And I believe he does acknowledge this in one of his other videos, but in that book, he says that because lobsters hold their, what do you call them? Claws.
Pincers?
Pincers. That's what
Their
pincers up high, if they're the alpha lobster, and they hold the pincers up high like that. Yeah. Therefore, young men should stand up straight and look people in the eye in order to overcome inhibition and social anxiety and low self-esteem and stuff, right? And when I read that, I did laugh, right? Because I used to work with a lot of tough guys. Like, I used to work with kids.
They walk around like this?
Nah, like, I didn't even notice that. Like, I worked with young guys in South London that had been in probation, that had been in Borstal, like, what you call it, juvenile detention, right? And I worked with the probation service. I worked with drugs projects. I worked with social exclusion units in schools, 3-4 different schools in South London a long time ago, right? And I really, it made me kind of hark back to that. And I thought, I think, I mean, the problem with one of these rules is they kind of work in some situations. So you'll always find some advocate that says, I stood up like a lobster and looked people dead in the eyes. Now everybody respects me. It's great. And then you think, well, good for you, buddy. That's like, you're an advocate of it. Like, you know, these are the testimonials you'll see. But what you don't see is some guy that does it and then, you know, got the bejesus kicked out of him in the playground or whatever. Like, so it made me laugh because I thought, I can't imagine giving that advice, you know.
Like an expert, you can't imagine as an expert, as a cognitive behavioral therapist in that field that has read, reviewed, written peer-reviewed studies, that you would give advice to somebody in terms of confidence to, you know, get past social anxiety, to stand up like a lobster and look at people in the eye.
In the streets of South London, if you're 15... and you're living a rough estate with a lot of drug users and your dad's in prison, like, I can imagine maybe that in some situations you're just gonna get your head kicked in, like, for doing that. Obvious, that would be common sense. I would think so. It seemed like weird advice to me. But anyway, from a psychological point of view, I'll give you an explanation that I know people find interesting, right? This is what research actually tells us about social anxiety that Jordan Peterson doesn't mention in that book, right? For some reason. So if you asked any cognitive behavioral therapist, they will tell you the following, right? What research shows is that there's a very, very high statistical correlation between severe social anxiety and self-focused attention. So high, it's like gold dust in psychological research. And so that's intuitive.
Self-attention. Can I just translate that for a little bit? Because this is something that we work on with my kids, just to popularize it a little bit for, you know, people like me that aren't as smart as you, is it's when you're in a moment, right? And you're focused on what you're saying and how people look at you. Yeah. As opposed to what you're saying and truly being mindful in that moment, right? That's where that social anxiety comes from, is it's a lack of confidence, questioning yourself all the time.
You hear it. We all know this because people that are socially anxious say, I felt like everyone was looking at me. I felt like I was the center of the attention when I walked in the room and stuff. And that makes them cringe, right? So it takes various forms. It could be you're thinking about your breathing. You're thinking about your hands shaking. Maybe you're actually looking at your hands. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about what's going on in your mind before you say it. You're imagining what your face looks like. And these are all different ways of focusing, of putting yourself under a magnifying glass while you're trying to have a conversation. Now, normally when you talk to people, this is easy. We know from research on human interaction, like people normally look at the other person's face, but their eyes go around in a kind of triangular motion. So you look from one eye to the other. The problem with looking in people's eyes is that they have too many of them, right? So you can't look at both eyes. Like you kind of have, so you look at one eye, then you look at the other eye, then you look at their mouth, and you sort of roughly go around. And then sometimes you look at their groin. And then usually you'll kind of like look away for a bit and then you'll look back again.
And you hope no one saw you look at their groin too.
Right. Like, oh my God. But if you just like look dead into somebody's eyes while you're talking to them, that seems creepy. And it seems quite aggressive usually, like if you're doing that, right? And it's a normal conversation. You kind of look at someone casually, you scan the face, you look away for a bit, you look back at them. That looks normal behavior to us. So like just staring into people's eyes is bad advice because it's going to make you look like you're a serial
psycho
killer.
Yeah.
And you're going to get head kicks in. Right. It's not a good idea. Like,
I don't like how a lot of the alternatives to being stoic in your world include getting your head kicked in South London or here on this podcast.
Try growing up in Scotland.
No, I would never mess with you. That's the other thing. I know you're a passive guy. I would never mess with you.
It's pretty, you know, it's a bit different. I think it's because in Britain we don't have guns. No. So people get in bar fights or like in Glasgow and stuff in Scotland. They love that sort of stuff because they're not worried about getting shot. Right. So they're like, it changes things. Anyway. So what we know is that self-focused attention contributes to social anxiety. And we know that if you train people to shift the focus, because focus of attention is to some extent under voluntary control. Mm-hmm. So you can train yourself to focus more on other people and less on yourself.
That I'll tell you what, that has been a work in progress with me for the past several years. And because you said something on a podcast with me a couple of years ago where you're thinking about what you're saying and how people are looking at you and what your mouth is doing and all those things. And you mentioned it quickly in a podcast. And I'm like, I do that sometimes. So it's been this constant cognitive effort on my part to be in the moment. And what you're talking about is something very real that I think a lot of us share a problem with.
In the moment, ironically, and when you're in the moment and you're talking to someone, you kind of forget about yourself, like, and you're focused on the stuff that you're saying, but you focus more on the ideas rather than on the sound of your voice or the particular words that you're using, right? You just get more lost in the subject. And you look at the other person, so you look to see if they look interested, if they look confused, and so you're more able to respond to social cues. Whereas people who are socially anxious often kind of avoid eye contact, right? And so that means they miss out on a lot of social cues. Mm-hmm. Or they're trying. So the other thing that they do is that people who have social anxiety usually use lots of self-help techniques that don't work. So they'll try and control their breathing. They'll repeat a mantra to themselves. They'll plan what they're going to say before they say it. And so they do all these kind of quasi self-improvement techniques, all of which increase cognitive load. Right. And in therapy, we have to train people to stop doing all this stuff, right? Because it confuses them, basically. They're trying to walk and chew gum at the same time, right? So you're trying to kind of like repeat a little mantra in your head, or you're trying to visualize something and have a normal conversation.
It's like when someone gives you golf advice, do this with your swing. You're thinking about doing 15 different things and you just
breathe differently. And you think, well, hang on, if I'm breathing differently, that's really distracting. Like, yeah. So that happens with social anxiety. So Jordan Peterson's advice to stand up tall and maintain eye contact is a classic example of advice that people typically are already doing when they come into therapy, and which is increasing self-focused attention, right? So they believe that that makes them more comfortable. But now, like, they're much more focused on their own body and posture than they would normally be.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
So that means they've only got half of their attention to give to the other. We know that that is statistically highly correlated with social anxiety, and it also increases cognitive load, so it's distracting. So for you to be thinking about maintaining a posture while talking to other people, like, it probably means you're going to lose your place in the conversation more often. It probably means you're going to hesitate more. You're going to feel more socially awkward. Like, it's the opposite of what we would normally teach people to do, and what all of the research suggests is beneficial in a situation like that. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is, it's bad psychological advice in a nutshell.
Is that what you're saying?
What's interesting about it is there are coping we know in cognitive therapy there are coping techniques that are like self-help techniques that people do that very often make the problem worse, right? And many of them people will just come up with themselves. And a lot of self-help, unfortunately, consists and just teaching these kind of common coping techniques that seem to work short term but make the problem worse in the longer term. And the whole point of studying research and clinical trials and stuff like that is that so you learn to differentiate between things that look like they work and things that actually work. Right. So breathing differently, trying to relax all your muscles, repeating a mantra, visual might seem like it works a bit, but we know that if you get people to do that over the long term, it usually just makes them feel more socially awkward and more self-conscious.
Yeah, right? Because you're in the corner chanting at a party trying to get over their social anxiety, and you're like,
it's
okay, now
it's unnatural, right? And what you need to do is train people to be more natural in a situation, and that requires abandoning all those bad habits and just focusing your attention more fluidly on the audience. So it's weird to me that a book would contain advice that's so obviously at odds with that. So that comes back to your original question of, do I know any cognitive behavioral therapists that recommend that book to their clients?
The answer is no.
And the answer would be no. And the reason would be that a lot of the advice in it just is inconsistent with.
There's no cognitive behavioral advice in any of his books.
There's other books. I'll tell you, but just comments. To introduce a bit of weird balance in this, right? And also, it kind of seems like I've read many self-help books over the years, because whenever a client came to me and said they'd been reading some self-help book, it's hard now because there's so many of them, but I would go out and read it. Because I think I want to know what my clients have learned from this and what they're.
Yeah, it gives you a roadmap of what you have to undo as well, right? In some cases.
And very often, like, ask any cognitive. Like, often at the beginning of therapy, the first thing you do is undo learnings that people have got from bad self-help advice. I'll give you an example of a book that I actually like that's a self-help book, right? And it's not perfect, but it doesn't come from a clinician. And I think it's got pretty good advice in it. And it's Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's an old book, right? I read that and I thought, kind of agree with most of the stuff it's kind of a lot of it's sort of common sense. I thought it was surprisingly well thought through, right? I think you can tell there's two types of book. There's books where you think this author says something on page 50 that contradicts what he says on page 5. Or he hasn't really thought through the consequences of something he suggested. So it seems the books that seem superficial, especially if you're familiar with the subject, you think, why doesn't this guy anticipate the obvious objections to the thing he just said? So you can tell if somebody's saying stuff that they haven't really thought through that much. Stephen Covey, when I read his book, I thought, I get the impression that he spent years thinking about this stuff and talking to people about it. It seems like it's very polished, like it's all very consistent. And there's a depth below the surface of consent. It's not the greatest book I've ever read, but I thought this is head and shoulders above 90% of the self-help books that I read.
The advice... Do you feel the same way about Stephen Covey? Do you feel the same way about James Clear's Atomic Habits?
I haven't read his book, actually. It's great. On my list of books to read because I'm quite interested in habit change. And what what research tells us about how to change habits. It's actually cognitive therapy doesn't really usually go into it. And we have a protocol for changing habits that's been around since the 1970s that has a really high, that in clinical trials has a 90% success rate, right? I'll tell you, this is a weird thing about therapy. I'm going to say something that's going to shock people, right?
Yeah.
A lot of researchers will say that most of the progress in clinical practice was made by the 1970s, like 1960s, 1970s. And then we've made much slower progress generally since then, with one exception, which is that in the mid-1980s, we figured out how to treat panic attacks. So there was a researcher at Oxford University in the UK that figured out the protocol for treating panic attacks. And now we have like about a 90% success rate in treating that. But in the 60s and 70s, we figured out the basic protocols for a whole bunch of anxiety disorders and insomnia and also basic habit disorders. And the key in that particular approach is to closely monitor what the signs are or triggers, like, so to anticipate that a bad habit is going to happen in advance. So to notice what the situations are where you typically have the bad habit. This is more about breaking bad habits. And to notice the early warning signs. So at an earlier stage than you normally would, which requires a bit of, sort of self-awareness training. And then to do something that's physically incompatible. So the classic example is fingernail biting. We have like a 90% success rate in treating that. So what we do is get people to notice before they've even raised their hand to their mouth what the feelings are, the emotions, the situations that indicate that they're about to engage in the habit. They often, with people who bite their fingernails, they fidget with their hands first, right? They start moving the fingers and fidgeting with the hands, and then gradually put the hands to the mouth. And it might be in certain times of day or situations they're more likely to do it. So they notice that first and catch it as early as they possibly can, and then they clench their fist for between 1 to 3 minutes, which is an eternity to clench your fist. It's really boring. Right. It doesn't sound like much, but like, and in practice, it's like 1 minute out of your day, right? Yeah. But it's really boring to do that. So you clench your fist and then you do some other stuff. But what that does is create it's called counter conditioning. So it creates a habit that's physically incompatible with, you can't bite your fingernails and clench your fist at the same time. You'd knock yourself out.
I might be able to give it the old college try.
Try it. So what you want is to get to a point where you habitually clench your fist when you begin to notice the fidgeting and the initial sign. And it only takes like a week or two for that to break the bad habit pretty reliably.
But that's kind of why I'm shocked you haven't read James Clear, because of how habitual the decision-making process needs to be in a stoic life, right? It's the idea that you've got to change your thinking, which means you need to change your behaviors, which will change your thinking as you go. But there's a commitment to that, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, habits and habit forming things will, thoughts, right, that we have that are compatible with the familial cast that we grew up with, that we kind of take with us through our life, they create those habits. They create the habits that we, you know, use to cope with bad things when maybe we get fired, when maybe, you know, we have a death in the family, where we'll turn to coping mechanisms to deal with them, like I used to do with alcohol, before you would turn to getting into why you feel this way. Why are you having this emotional reaction? And that's the challenging of your perception, the challenging of your thoughts. You're not looking for any silver linings. You're not grateful for the time you've spent with that person in the case of maybe someone dying and you being filled with grief, right? We always pivot to the most emotional thing, the most selfishly emotional thing. And that's what I love about Stoicism, is that in a time when, you know, we needed it, at a time when I needed it, specifically history repeating itself over the past 3-4 years, I was a mob guy, right? I'm a guy that was easily influenced by the people around me that didn't really apply critical thought to situations that would have these emotional reactions and then manage the fallout from those emotional reactions after I would have them. As opposed to being able to, as you point out, being able to see those habits ahead of time, know what those habits do to you, the shame that comes with them, but you have to have the self-awareness or the intellectual ability to be able to apply those habits on a daily basis for a while until you see the fruit of what your habits and your new thinking have created for you and how you respond for that. And I think that that's the work a lot of people don't want to do, Donald. Like when I talk to people and you say, hey, listen, the way you look at life is poisonous. You need to look at it from this perspective. Let's talk about these things. They all have the same reaction, which is why guys that do the self-help hack books like Jordan Peterson are so successful. They're like, ooh, that's going to require a lot of self-reflection and challenging my core belief system. I don't think I'm ready to do that.
No, what you want is more of the same. Like, so I want to carry on blaming everybody, but get rid of my anger. Mm. Well, how? Like, you know, like you're just blaming everybody that causes. My background, I can explain very briefly. Like, you know, this is the truth. When I was a kid growing up in Scotland, we still had corporal punishment in schools until I was like, I think about 8 or 10 years old or something like that.
Did you get the strap? I got the strap. We had that.
Strapped on a regular basis. Yeah. Like, and then at home, like one of the biggest changes I saw in my lifetime was banning corporal punishment. Mm-hmm. Because everybody, like, not all of my friends, but like, I don't know, like half my friends, their parents would whip them like with a dog's leash or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or they just spank kids or whatever.
Branch. I got the branch wooden spoon. Did you get the wooden spoon?
I didn't get a wooden spoon. I got the dog's leash.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I got the leash.
My mother had a drawer full of leather straps.
Items.
And she'd just go over and she'd put her hand on the handle of the drawer as a kind of threat, a warning. Like, okay. Like, but what it did to me was I grew up, it just made me really angry. Like, and I remember when I was a young guy, absolutely kind of like boiling over with rage. And in some ways, like, you know, what happened was it kind of went on so long and it burned so deep inside me. I just reached a point where I thought, I can't go on like this. And I just started to become more, I guess, reflective about my anger. And I was conscious that I was mainly angry about stuff that had happened to me in the past. So just by reflecting on it and questioning it, and then through subsequently discovering Stoicism, it really made me feel, more than anything else, if I was to sum it up in a word, you know, I just really in my guts, started to feel it wasn't worth it. Mm. I just started to notice the anger and think it's pointless. It's like I'm banging my head against a wall. Mm. Like, I might as well be punching myself in the face. Like, you know, it's, why am I doing this to myself? Mm. It felt pointless. And so all the kind of energy just evaporated out of it over time, you know, and I still get irritated with things occasionally, but nothing like, you know, what I used to when I was a kid, because I came to see it as a waste of energy, basically, and harmful in many ways. You know, it just got me into trouble and it clouded my judgment. So it made me, I could see that it made me kind of paranoid. And
as always, the Dean Blundell Show is brought to you by our friends at factcheck.io. Factcheck.io. Do you believe? The good people at FactCheck are a quorum of software professionals, psychological professionals, journalists, that have been very busy building some software so that you can fact check anything that you read. It doesn't matter if it's got a URL, you'll be able to fact check it. Alternative sources, origins, whether or not it was an organic or inorganic campaign, whether or not you can trust the people that are putting out the information, and alternative sources. And there's going to be a weapon button too, where you can turn that information around and put it back out there accurately to combat disinformation. The good people at factcheck.io are right now testing their beta version of their free program. Yes, it will be free for anybody who wants to use it. They want to battle disinformation because it is a problem. Go to factcheck.io today, FAKTCHEK.io, FAKTCHEK.io. The world's most robust fact-checking disinformation software for news, social media, video, print, anything spoken word. These people are on the tip. And they use some of the finest software technology to be able to give you the advantage when it comes to getting agency back in your life, when it comes to information that you read. Go to factcheck.io today for more information. Sign up for the beta test, FAKTCHEK.io. The Dean Blundell Show is brought to you by factcheck.io. Factcheck.io, makers of the world's most comprehensive fact-checking software, that have been very busy building some software so that you can fact check anything that you read. It doesn't matter if it's got a URL, you'll be able to fact check it. Alternative sources, origins, whether or not it was an organic or inorganic campaign, whether or not you can trust the people that are putting out the information so that you can give yourself agency over information in the age of disinformation. Again, want to beta test their product? They're going to launch it in the next month or two. Go to factcheck.io today, FAKTCHEK.io. Back to the show.
You know, unreasonable about
it affected your quality of life, right? Like it just, it, you know, when you're that angry, and I, you know, I love the fact that you shared that because, like you, you know, we're all triggered by familial upbringings, and our perception is shaped by those things and those events. You know, I grew up with a dad who drank too much, super physical, and you know. That it is impossible to go through life that angry, to your point, right? And so identify with what you're saying to the point where it affects every area of your life. And you're like, man, I don't want to live like this. I don't want to live triggered, angry, unhappy, pissed off at the world, like not available to have conversations because I'm thinking about something that happened to me that I didn't do. Right. It had nothing to do with me. That was the actions of another person that make me feel this way. But I have an opportunity to understand it. And like you, I mean, you say it kind of fell off. But did that not require years of work, years of leaning into it, understanding it?
Yeah. Like when I was even from a pretty early age, I was lucky that I kind of got into Buddhism and I started doing all sorts of self-help stuff. Mm-hmm. It took me 10 years or something before I really came across Stoicism. And then a light went on for me. I thought, well, this is like everything that I've been looking for all in one place, you know, and it really clicked with me. So I felt this is, I've arrived home. This is my thing. But before that, I was into all sorts of different, like I got really into self-hypnosis and auto-suggestion and Buddhist meditation. I used to go on Buddhist retreats and stuff like that. Kind of like fishing around for something that would click. And I got some benefit from all of this sort of stuff. But then when I got to Stoicism, I thought this just makes a lot more as a whole framework and a philosophy to me that I can permanently identify with. We said we were going to talk about tattoos as well.
Yeah, just to let you know, and I've got a son who's sitting not far from me, but all of my sons now have amor fati, which is the love of fate, memento mori, remember you're mortal. These two sayings are the filter for my life and the decisions that I make and the enjoyment and the decision that I make to put a smile on my face every day.
Yeah.
The decision that I make to respond to bad things and welcome them because it is fate. That is, we're here for the business of life. And that tattoo means the world to me. I know you're all tatted up too. And it's funny because when I got the tattoo, I'm like, what did the Stoics say about tattoos? Eh, whatever. I'm going to get one anyway.
They never had, like in the ancient world, the tattoos are unusual because it was mainly slaves who had tattoos. So they saw it as a kind of, in a negative light, as a sort of an indication for most of like antiquity in Greece and Rome as an indication that someone might be a slave. The Scythians were known for having lots of tattoos, for example. But those two things, like, so acceptance and also that what goes with that is gratitude, mm-hmm. are integral, I think, to a quality. Like, how can you be happy unless you find a way to feel grateful for being alive, right? You have to, I figured that out. I've got to find a perspective from which I can experience gratitude for being alive in general. Otherwise, what's the point of it? You can't go through life bitter, right? You have to find something to be grateful for. And memento mori, to be aware, I think for many people, it's a brush with death, which is something that's more common, I think, than most people realize. Like, many people have at some point in their life thought maybe they were going to die, maybe they were doing a dangerous sport, or maybe they were in hospital, they were in a car crash or something like that. A lot of people, I think, have at least a moment where they think, maybe this is it, you know. And often, but not always, that can snap you out of your complacency. It wakes you out of the trance, as it were, and you think, maybe I'm wasting my time on social media, or, you know, like, maybe I'm in the wrong job or something.
Maybe I should be nicer to people today. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I should be nicer to, like, it makes you think, what is really important in life? And the other thing that can do that is bereavement. So my father passed away when I was about 13. And I think that really, it was a very dark time for me, but it benefited me in the sense that it made me really, I looked at my father. My father took a long time to die. He had lung cancer, like, and he died at home, not in a hospice, like, over a long, long period. So every time I go home to the house, my father was lying, dying in bed. And it forced me to kind of think, I could see my father was very bitter. I thought about that he hadn't had a good enough life. He regretted maybe not having had the life that he wanted. And I just thought, I don't want to end up like that. Mm. Like, I don't want to get to the end of my life and think I've kind of frittered it away or wasted it. Mm-hmm. Doing pointless stuff. And most of us spend most of our time doing worthless, trivial things, like on social media, watching TV shows. Has anyone ever had engraved on their gravestone, I wish I'd spent more time on Twitter? Or, when I die, what I want you to chisel in the tomb immemorial is,
I went viral in 2020.
Yeah. Just so you know, like, you know, somebody famous once liked one of my tweets, or I wish I'd spent more time watching Friends episodes. Like,
I met Wayne Gretzky.
Yeah, I met Wayne Gretzky, or something like that. Right. I mean, that seems absurd.
Yeah.
So when you get to the end of your life, or when you start to think about your own mortality, it forces you to radically question your values and look for values that are more fulfilling, that so you might actually, you know, experience gratitude for your life and some kind of sense of fulfillment for what you're doing. I was going to say, CBT, what's missing? The holy grail, Dean, of mental health is summed up in the slogan, prevention is better than cure, right? So by the time that someone comes to see a psychotherapist, it's late in the game, Dean. Like, they're already having problems, right? And so everybody that works in mental health knows, like, it's kind of late, right? We can do therapy, but ideally we wouldn't have to do therapy because we would have prevented them getting depressed or anxious in the first place. Prevention would be much better than waiting until people get depressed and then trying to help them get undepressed, right? That's not a logical way of managing mental health. And in psychology, we call mental health prevention, stress prevention, it's sometimes called. We usually call it emotional resilience building, right? Mm. So resilience is the trait that you would have if you were not vulnerable to depression and anxiety disorders, right? And so obviously the target groups for that have often been school children or people entering service in the military, or sometimes people undertaking stressful or dangerous jobs, like to prepare them so that they're going to be less vulnerable in high stress situations. But that research is still in its infancy compared to psychotherapy, right? And one of the things that we found is that we can train people to become more emotionally resilient using cognitive behavioral therapy techniques and problem-solving skills and positive psychology and stuff like that. However, it seems to often only last a couple of years. And then you have to do booster courses, right? So the holy grail would be if you could train like once and done, would be like if you could train people, get them when they're young and make them permanently resilient, that would be a big deal, right? And it would seem like what we're doing is kind of trivial in therapy if you could on a large scale do long-term prevention rather than something that works for a few years and you have to keep boosting it, right? Now, the one of the reasons that Stoicism is interesting is that it inspired CBT. It's based on the same premise about the nature of emotion as CBT. It contains similar techniques and techniques that are in many ways compatible with CBT. But Stoicism is for life, not just for Christmas. Like when people get into it, they often stay into it, right?
Yeah, it's not Stoicism is a philosophy, right? It's not a religion. It's supposed to be there for you to assess critically. It is, and it has answers that as you point out are the birthplace for cognitive behavioral therapy.
Funnily enough, the thing I would draw an analogy with is yoga. So, like yoga, in some ways, performs better than other treatments for back problems, like Pilates. Or physiotherapy exercise, likely to do yoga permanently. Mm-hmm. Like they get into it and they remain into it because there's like a lifestyle and a kind of culture.
It's a way of life for a lot of yogis, right? They're like, it's social. I enjoy it. It calms me down. It's therapeutic. It's physical. It's all those things.
So you might do Pilates and you might do yoga, and the Pilates might actually be more benefit for your back problem or whatever, but you might do it for a year and then get fed up with it and quit, right? Whereas you might do the yoga and get slightly less benefit from it, perhaps, but you might do it forever, right? And so what matters more is, are you going to continue this to benefit from it permanently, right? And so Stoicism is like that, right? Even if it differs from CBT in some ways, and we can always like make adjustments to it and things like that, nobody gets into CBT, or very few people get into CBT and go back. David Burns' is Feeling Good is one of the best-selling books on CBT. Nobody rereads it every year, right? But people reread Marcus Aurelius over and over again, and they remain in the same way that they get into Buddhism or yoga or something. They stay. Now, the point I'm making is about tattoos, right? I've never met anybody to this day, and I feel like I've thrown a gauntlet down because I've always said this, and to this day, no one's come forward. I've never met a single person so far with a quote from a CBT book tattooed on them. Like, I've never met anyone with a picture of Albert Ellis or Aaron T. Beck tattooed on their back or whatever, right? Or anywhere else on their anatomy.
See a lot of Aurelius quotes too, a couple Seneca's, Epictetus's.
Yeah. I see loads of people with Stoicism tattoos. I've got a Stoicism tattoo. Ryan Holiday's got people send them to me on the internet all the time. It's like there's websites where people have collated pictures.
Stoic tattoos. There's subreddits where it's like, show me your Stoic tattoo.
Tattoo, right? Yeah. But I'm being a bit glib, but the point I'm making is that people identify with it at a deeper level, so much so that it's becomes like it's a philosophy of life, or some people might say it's like a religion. It's like Buddhism. And that people get into it long term, or they get into it. Now that's gold dust in mental health terms. Because if it's healthy and you get into it long term, it's far more valuable. Like it doesn't seem like it at first, because you could do something that's really good for you, but you might only do it for a year. And this is a big problem in mental. Like so, for example, in relationships counseling, the leading researchers found that we could give couples problem-solving skills and we could give them communication skills that help with relationship problem. But when we followed up a year or 2 years later, like they initially benefit, but then 2 years later, they've just gone back to what they were doing before, because it takes an effort to keep using these principles. And if you're doing them to kind of overcome a problem, sometimes the motivation wanes and you just revert back to what you're doing before. But if you identify, like, at a high cognitive level, like, you think, this is who I am. I'm a Buddhist, you know, I'm a Stoic or whatever. There's more likelihood that you're going to carry on doing it forever, right? And then you benefit from it forever. Like, and that's a whole different ballgame from giving people a bag of tricks that they do for a year or two and then quit doing.
Because they don't work, because it's not foundational, right? And I think that that's the thing. And you point that out, you know, the cascading effect of being able to teach your kids, share these stories with your kids of Marcus Verissimus. By the way, that's how I introduced my son, is through your book, To Stoicism, because it's an illustrated book, Verissimus. I would highly encourage everybody to go get it. And what you're talking about is legitimate. You talk about gold dust. It's something that has been wiped off the face of the earth over the past couple thousand years because of competing interests and ideology. And I say this to my sons all the time, is that we're in the business of raising men. And so we lean on the wisdom of ancients. We talk to the dead, and we talk to the dead about a way to perceive life so that you can manage as unfair as this life is going to be, because we have seen a collection of unfair recently, right? Why is this way? This is, and I've got one son, he's 18. He is, we call him couch questions. He sits on the couch, and just since he was two, question after question after question after question. And there is one topic of discussion in our family that is readily available to help everybody with their emotional needs that, you know, comes with really cool quotes. Life is a cliche. We mention that all the time. It comes with historical knowledge and reading about people who've been there before and the necessity of being able to manage this life properly, not by quick life hacks or Band-Aid solutions or a new book or some kind of new diet, but you got to do the work. And we're in the business of life, and we are not exempt from bad things. And so when that is a starting point and you understand and your children understand, you are creating generations of people that can manage this life and manage this world and manage bad things that happen to them on a daily basis to the point where it doesn't defeat them. Right. I think that that was the point for me. That's the wake that my children live in. And I think that's the wake a lot of people should live in if they're involved with somebody who understands that being a good person, fruit of this life, is of good character and acts for the common good. And that is the filter of who you will become, and the repetitive nature of the decisions you make to be that person will affect not just you and your happiness. That's karma, man. That's what I talk about all the time with these guys. I'm like, no, man, you make great decisions. You create great environments around you. You know, if you listen to the Stoics, if you listen to Marcus Aurelius about, you know, your mind being full of thoughts, you know, your soul is dyed with the color of your thoughts. You are the people you hang around with. Learn from the best. Want to be somebody, go and hang around with the people you want to be like. Learn from these people, respond well to life. And these are the things that make men men in my mind. You know, I look back on that time, and it, obviously confusion with philosophy and different ideologies and all the things that, you know, in the cradle of civilization and humanity, we were being birthed and becoming these people. But man, oh man, you go back 2,000 years and you're like, oh, this is the stuff. This is how you look at life today, because they went through what we're going through. They just didn't have any cell phones back then.
Yeah, it's amazing how many parallels there. That's where we started, but there are many, many parallels. And it's amazing, you know, it's I find it remarkable, the psychological insights that we get in Stoicism. I don't say that lightly, but they were way ahead of their time. You know, there are things that we don't even have English words for that the Stoics discovered that are of psychological significance that we know in modern psychological research. Like, it's really quite remarkable. And some of it, in a sense, it's common sense. They didn't have the benefit of being able to conduct research studies. They were just kind of reflecting very deeply on their own experience, but at a far deeper level, you know, than we normally would. And if anyone doubts that, you know, the fact that they were so far ahead of their time, I'd remind them that it wasn't that long ago that psychotherapy was dominated by Sigmund Freud and all of the many offshoots of Freudian psychoanalysis, which led everybody in a completely the opposite direction from what the Stoics were teaching. You know, Freud had no idea that clients would benefit from teaching them that their emotions are cognitive in nature, and, you know, that they could learn to question rationally the beliefs that are making them anxious or afraid. That just wasn't on his radar. Like, he thought of things from a completely different perspective. And yet, you know, research indicates that the Stoics were right in that regard. They were much closer to the truth than Freud and Jung and all those kind of guys were.
Like 2,000 years earlier.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the part that blows my mind all.
Well, Freud was a huge backward step, in a sense, right? I'll tell you, like, I could go on.
Do you think it was the heroin and cocaine? You think, like, that was it?
It might. Have you seen the letter that he wrote?
Yeah.
He wrote a letter saying, "I'm going to embrace you like a great wild beast," to his, a wild man, to his wife. He goes, "I've been taking loads of cocaine and giving it to all my patients. It's a wonder drug. It seems to do everything." Like, he wrote this letter that's insane. But Freud was
out there.
He, in all, like, when I was a young guy, like, Freudian psychoanalysis was still kind of influential.
Mm-hmm.
It still is in some countries, like in Brazil and in France, like, there's still a legacy of Freudianism that lingers. In Britain, it's toast, right? Hardly anyone would, like, you know, and to America, Canada, to some extent, like, Britain actually leads the world in embracing evidence-based clinical practice and mental health, by the way, because our government invested so much money in a thing called the IAP program.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one thing I'm quite, you know, proud of.
Yeah, you were part of that program, right? Didn't you have that program on?
I was kind of, like, I worked very briefly, like, in an NHS clinic. I've got a good friend, like, that works in the, they call it the Talking Therapies Program now or something. They changed the name, but it used to be called IAPT. Mm-hmm. Like, but Britain leads the world in that regard. So it's odd to me then to speak to psychotherapists and other, again, to come back to Jordan Peterson. Mm-hmm. When I first read, and I'm not saying this to, it sounds like I'm being derogatory about him, right? But in all honesty, if someone gave me a copy of his book and they covered up the cover and I didn't know who it was written by or what it was called or when it was written, and I'm flicking through it, I would have assumed it was written in 1970, right? Because it's mainly Jungian, right? I think it's fair to say. I mean, yeah, the book is even more Jungian, I think, than most people realize. There's pages and pages and pages of it where he goes on about the book of Genesis, mm-hmm, and what the snake symbolizes and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, are these, like, are his fans really interested in this? It's New Age biblical theology. This is like books from the, I used to love reading those books that in the 70s, they were kind of more popular. But this is not what a modern book on mental health or psychotherapy would look like. I can't explain how different it is. You would not find, like, a dozen pages about the symbolism of the book of Genesis in a book about evidence-based practice and clinical psychology, right?
Evidence being the key word. Yeah.
I mean, I love shit like that, but it's really weird, right? And weirdest thing about the book is, at the beginning, I had to ignore, I started reading that book and I kept saying to myself, I'm going to ignore that bit, like, because I think it's going to, like, prejudice me against the rest of it. So I'm going to pretend he didn't say that. Let's skip past that. I want to see what the rest of it says. But at the beginning, he says he had a dream in which there's this cosmic cathedral. And he says the roof of the cathedral is shaped like a cross from which he's suspended, Christ-like, right? And he talks about, I think he says there's a great wind and he experiences all of the suffering of the world. And he's reluctant to do it because he's like a reluctant messiah. Like, he said, I don't want this. I don't want to take on all of the suffering. But then he realizes that he has to do it anyway. And it's his mission in life to be the messiah, right? Apparently. And I'm like, I'm reading this thinking,
did he steal that from Meditations? Did he steal that with the ivory shoulders? That's what I'm wondering. Did he steal that from
Marcus? Thinking, is it maybe like Frank Herbert or something? Is June? Like, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, what planet are we on right now? Like, this is not a book on, this is written by a professor of clinical psychology.
Yeah.
Like, and it, for sure, this just sounds like you're like a cult or something. So I'm like, I'm gonna pretend I didn't rip those pages. I didn't read that. Like, I'm just gonna, like, start again.
So now you're up to, like, the first two things you read in the book, pretending you didn't read them.
Yeah. Yes. I'm like, let's kind of take it from, like, let's start again.
Chapter three. Yeah.
Like, I don't pretend there wasn't all the weird stuff at the beginning about how he's a messianic, like, figure. And, like,
did you read about, did you ever read the interpretation of his dream that he had about his grandmother?
No, I haven't seen that. That's not in that book.
Oh, no, it's not in that book, but it's like maybe one of his other books, but it's just this dissertation that he wrote about a dream he had about his grandmother who was also naked in the dream and some of the things that went on in the dream and how he interpreted the dream. And I'm like, I don't know if I'd even tell anybody about that dream, because it's like, it's one of those dreams you have where you're like, I can't tell anybody I had this dream. Like it's a terribly graphic, disgusting dream. Yes.
There's a lot of weird stuff in it. Anyway, kids, don't like, just read something out. Like, go and ask at like a bunch of people who just, not even egg, just ask people who work in the field. What does the research actually say about dealing with your anxiety and your anger and stuff like that? And don't start with, I mean, maybe you could go check that stuff out later, but
what are you doing? No, don't check it out ever.
But check out, first of all, check out what psychological research actually says about the problems that you're experiencing. It would be like if you had a broken leg or something, or you had something that you went to go to the doctor for, right? So you go to the actual doctor for, like, go to mainstream medicine first, maybe. At least give it a go. Check out what it says. Don't start with like a witch doctor or something. Like, don't begin by going full new age stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but go begin with what doctors say might be good for the illness that you've got. And then, you know, if they tell you to go and read this book, then fine.
Sure.
But they won't. I'm telling you right now, they won't. I'd be surprised. I'd be very surprised if they did. But I don't know how we got onto that. But like, yeah, we were just talking about.
We're just shooting the shit. You know what? It's funny because anytime, like, again, you're a better human being than me. You've got more time at this. You're a smarter man than me. But like, I watch you struggle in these conversations about Jordan Peterson, and you and I have shared a few DMs in the past because some of the stuff's crazy. And I always, and I know where the truth is. It's in what you're saying. It's not in any of that Fugazi BS, right? It just isn't. It's impossible to become a better person by blaming everybody else. Just, it doesn't make any math sense.
I know what I wanted to tell you, right?
Yeah, yeah. What did you want to say?
Okay, so I was kind of feel like I'm picking on this guy, actually. I'll pick on someone else in a minute.
Oh, no.
We started talking about Freud, and I wanted to say, like, when I was a young guy, I would criticize Freud, right? And everyone's like, whoa, you can't criticize Freud, he's a genius, blah, blah, blah. And then I have exactly the same feeling about Jordan Peterson. It's the same as when people were criticizing Freud. You get the same kind of pushback. Like, the people that are really into it take every criticism like to be just a personal attack on Freud or Peterson or Jung or whoever it is. And also, these thinkers often don't justify anything that they're saying. Or the justification that they give is kind of incoherent. It's like, it's lobsters, or it's kind of like, it doesn't make sense. So it's hard to critique them without just rolling your eyes and being like, you know, where do you even begin? But it's the same. It happened with Freud. And weirdly, Freud and Peterson are very different at one level, but another level, it's exactly the same. You know, people were obsessed with Freud. It was like a huge cultural film. Now people look back on it and they think there are bits you could take from it, but you're kind of scraping the barrel a bit. Like, most of what Freud said, nobody believes anymore. No one believes that all mental health problems are caused by wanting to have sex with your mum. Like, and
so the Oedipus complex was a lie, is what you're saying.
No one believes that, right? Even Freud's followers didn't really believe it. Jung didn't believe that, really.
Yeah,
like, he kind of thought there might be a bit of truth in it. Like, he didn't really believe it. Like, none of all the subsequent generations of Freudians are all but trying to get away from that a bit. Mm-hmm. Like, and it didn't work anyway. Freud never did any clinical trials at all. Like Peterson. Peterson never engages in any research on any of the stuff that he's saying.
Like, he doesn't have any peer-reviewed papers, does he? Like, not one.
He's published a lot of peer-reviewed research in personality theory, mainly, from what I understand. But the things that he says in his self-help book, like, I'll make a general point, right? If someone comes along and they say that they figured out an alternative way to treat depression or an alternative way to treat anxiety or anger or whatever, and like the kind of what the research evidence and what most of the clinicians are doing, forget about that. Like, I've got something better. They would do a clinical trial on it and prove that it works if they really believed in it, right? And particularly if you come from that field, if you're a clinical psychologist, you kind of, people would expect, well, oh, are you going to do a clinical trial on that? Or are you going to at least do some kind of like initial studies?
It doesn't matter what the trial is. It could be a psychological trial. It could be a medical trial. You want to prove if you're on the leading edge of whatever that field is, you do it with a clinical trial.
Yeah, or at least some other kind of recognized research method, right? Yeah. Something, right? You don't just go, I reckon that this cures depression. And then you can kind of get away with that if you're a self-help guru, if you're Andrew Tate or something. But it's odd for a professor of clinical psychology to do that, like in 12 Rules, to come out with lots of things that he hasn't tested, right? And that no one else has ever tested, and to kind of put that forward as a self-improvement. I mean, when we're talking about Stoicism, what I'd normally say is that some of the advice that the Stoics give, we know will probably work because it's pretty similar to things that there are many, many studies supporting. And that's part of the reason that I'm into it. And then there might be other bits that I go, we don't know for sure whether this works or not, but it seems plausible. But what Peterson's doing, like a lot of self-help writers, is promoting ideas that they haven't tested, which is a strange thing to do in an era when we do have research on mental health and we do have clinical trials. Because especially if you're a professor of clinical psychology, or really anyone with enough money, if you came up with an innovative idea for curing a problem, you would be well advised to do a clinical trial on it because you would change history. And it's not, people go, oh, it's really hard to organize. It's not that hard to organize a clinical trial. Like, or there are much smaller scale studies that you can do that cost like negligible amount of money. And if you have connections in the university, for sure you can, you know, you can organize to get that done. So there's no excuse, like, if you come up with a novel therapeutic idea for not, like, you know, committing to it and doing some research to substantiate it. Freud never did that. Mm-hmm. Freud, there was a Stoic psychotherapy at the beginning of the 20th century that was developed by a guy called Paul Dubois, who was a very famous psychiatrist, Swiss psychiatrist. And he was Freud's rival. And he was really into Seneca and developed a psychotherapy based on Stoicism, which was around really until the 1960s to some extent. But psychoanalysis completely eclipsed it, because psychoanalysis, I mean, Freud wrote entire books about sexual perversions. And I know people will go nuts about this, but I don't care. It's the truth, right? One of the reasons that Freud became so popular was because a lot of people were fascinated by the stuff that he said about sex. Right, the people at the beginning of the 20th century had never seen books by sexologists and people describing sexual perversions, and it gave them a kind of weird outlet, like studying. It's like dudes that go and look at pictures of naked women in anthropological exhibits in the Natural History Museum or something like that, right? It's like, you know, Freud would say, well, apparently there's this tribe and everybody's really into anal sex or something like that. So I'm going to discuss this. And I had some clients that had this weird, like, fetish that they'd, you know, about high heel shoes and people in the beginning of the 20th century found that salacious. And the press were all over it.
Yeah. Like, hot. They found it hot. They're like, ooh, this is rock star psychology he's talking about.
It was sensational, yeah. Right? And people go nuts at me for saying this, but it's true. Historically, Freud attracted a lot of publicity because he was talking a lot about sexual perversions, and that was highly sensational and attracted a lot of attention from the media, from the public in general, and so he became very famous. And the weird thing is, all that sexual stuff really dropped out of psychoanalysis. Even over time, a lot of his followers kind of gradually let that slide, so it became less and less of a part of what they were doing, even though they claimed to be influenced by Freud. So, I mean,
like, it was a marketing ploy.
right? It's funny how, you know, e-commerce today and hooks and getting people to read your stuff. And I know Freud was largely messed up. Like, I get it. I know that he was a drug addict. I know that he was into hallucinogenics.
I'll give you a good quote about that. Ernest Jones, who's a Welsh psychiatrist, and he was one of Freud's friends, and his official biographer said that Ernest Jones was a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist as well. He said Freud was the most neurotic man that he'd ever met. Like, so Freud was a really weird guy, right? By anyone's standards.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he had a phobia for the number 11, I think it was.
Did he really? He didn't like the number? Like, what if something was on the 11th floor? Would he go?
Well, he was staying in a hotel once and they booked him into room 22. And apparently he thought about it for a minute and he went, that's 2 times 11. Like, I can't, can you give me another room? Like, and he wouldn't travel by train because he was on a train once when he was a young guy. And he saw his, like, they were traveling overnight in a train. And he saw his mother naked or something like that because they were, like, sleeping in this carriage, like, in berth or whatever you call it, like. And this traumatized him. And so he had a phobia, a travel phobia. What were his other weird... He had social anxiety. He didn't like people looking at him. And that's partly why he insisted on sitting behind them and they had to lie on the couch looking at the wall, which is not how we would normally... Normally when we do therapy now, everyone else thinks it's better to face the client.
You wanted to look at him.
Yeah. Yeah. And Freud was like, no, I want you facing the other way, right? Looking at the wall, which was weird. I mean, he had other, they had other rationales for doing that, but hardly anyone, no modern therapists that aren't into Freud think that that's a good way to do therapy, right?
No.
But he didn't like people looking. He said that he didn't like people looking at him. He also, he had all these weird, like, sexual hangups himself. Freud's mother was younger than his sisters because his father remarried. And so he had this very elderly father and relatively young mother. And apparently they all grew up sleeping in one room together. Mm-hmm. So he had quite confused ideas growing up about the family dynamic.
Yeah, it sounds like Freud, like, from everything you're saying and what little I know about him, and you know obviously more than me, but sounds like his like psychological philosophy or his theories were born out of trauma of how he grew up, and he just applied that to everybody else.
When his father died, he had a lot of bad dreams about the death of his father.
Yeah.
And he analyzed them and he came to the conclusion that he had castration anxiety, that his father, he was frightened his father was going to castrate him, and that he wanted to sleep with his mother, who was this very young, relatively young woman that he glimpsed naked by accident on a train once. And that then he just literally, he was sitting in an armchair smoking a cigar with slippers on, and he thought, I think I want to shag my mom and I'm frightened that my dad's going to castrate me. I reckon everyone else does too, right? And that's kind of the extent of his research, right? He did zero actual clinical research, nothing. At a time when
all the Freud fans are going to be really mad at you today.
They're going to be super mad at me.
Super mad.
Jeff Woods, and I'm shining a light on music and the rock stars who make it.
He just was one of those people, he stood out.
He was a magic guy. He really was a magic guy. We all have force. He had the same amount of force as we all have.
This was before Led Zeppelin. Robert was full on. I mean, he was Led Zeppelin without the band behind him. He had the hair, the jeans, the whole thing, you know. And he was amazing.
The Records and Rockstars podcast, heard around the world and yours to hear wherever you get podcasts. All the episodes from JeffWoodsRadio.com.
I'm Matt Kundle, host of the Sound Off Podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.